So let's just welcome everyone to tonight. So welcome to Citizens Climate University. It's a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobby that provides CCL supporters like you and I with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics relating to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and tonight's topic is covering the basics behind motivational interviewing. So let's jump right in and introduce our wonderful guest speaker tonight. We have joining us Dr. Dave Christian, who is a licensed psychologist, and in addition to his clinical practice, Dave has been conducting motivational interviewing trainings for 25 years with advocates, lobbyists, physicians, psychologists, counselors, and other professionals across the board. Dr. Christian received his PhD in professional and scientific psychology and has taught as professor of psychology at University of Idaho for 6 years. You may have also bumped into him at any of the conferences in DC the last couple of years. He does a wonderful communications workshop for people interested in attending those seminars ahead of our actual lobby day. And if we've done our job well, our three learning objectives by the end of tonight's training are to learn the history and overview of motivational interviewing, along with the spirit of its approach, an acronym known as PACE, and Dave will get into that in just a little bit. We'll also have the chance to highlight how to use its core skills, including open-ended questions, affirmations, reflective listening, and summarizing, a convenient acronym as well. You'll get a window into all the acronyms out there in the world of MI, and that is ORS. And Dave will also define, demonstrate, and discuss putting these core skills into actions with your own conversations and a chance to practice them. So with that, Dave, I will pass it to you. Thank you all for joining us, and we're so honored for you making the time tonight, Dave, to be with us.
My pleasure. Well, let's dive right in. Some of you have experienced a motivational interviewing workshop either at our national conference, and occasionally we do these at regional conferences, but I'm going to begin with the assumption that most of you are new to MI, and the worst thing that will happen is you'll get a little review if you've had experience already with MI. First question most people ask is, what is MI? So here's a very succinct definition. Motivational interviewing is a communication method that motivates cooperation. A little bit of history to put this into perspective. First of all, let's contrast motivational interviewing with what most of us naturally do. If you've been a parent, an employer, or anybody else in the business of motivating other people, you have probably tried one of these 10 methods, if not others like them. Reasoning, ranting, warning, scaring, challenging, demanding, blaming, proving, lecturing, or disapproving, all as ways to try to motivate cooperation, collaboration, or some kind of movement. Psychology has been studying motivation for many, many years, and we've discovered something very paradoxical about these rather traditional methods. They cause what we call the backfire effect. So even though your intentions are good, maybe you're a great debater, and you're just chock full of great facts, if you use these traditional methods with your member of Congress or anybody else for that matter, you may notice something strange. In spite of you having great facts, great persuasive techniques, more often than not, at the end of the conversation, the other party is probably slightly more entrenched in defending their existing opinions. What a paradox. This can't be for lack of good effort on your part. And it's not your fault. It's that the method you're using is flawed. Sir Isaac Newton, which most of you may remember from a brief blush with physics, said that for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. He was, of course, speaking of the physical world, but of course this seems to apply equally with regard to interpersonal communication. The more we push people and to go in a certain direction, there's a strange tendency for them to resist. Well, if that doesn't work, what, pray tell, does? These two individuals back in 1983, Bill Miller and Steve Rolnick, were, and I won't go into all the history, it's quite fascinating, but they were tasked with coming up with something to get around the backfire effect. And after considerable research, they lit upon a set of methods that had demonstrable efficacy in helping people move in the desired direction, even when they were not necessarily so inclined to begin. So this, again, had its first publication back in 1983. Since that time, We have now accumulated over 1,400 studies demonstrating the effectiveness of MI in a variety of settings, with medical patients, in business, industry, across many, many settings. And this is the reason that I train motivational interviewing to a wide variety of professionals, both in this country and in Canada. Professionals and other people find it very useful because you get around the typical defensiveness that we unfortunately run into using our traditional methods. That's what we'd like to share with you tonight. Motivational interviewing has what we call a spirit. It's really the attitude that is essential if you're going to apply it effectively. This spirit of MI is, we have an acronym. You'll see we have acronyms for most things. It just helps remember things a little better. We call this PACE. PACE stands for a partnership of equals. So when we do motivational interviewing, we see the other party as a partner. We'll get into this in more detail later on, because we'll go into this and ORS. I'll give you a quick overview of the whole model, and then we'll zero in on two parts of it tonight. We also are going to show acceptance and empathy for the other party and respect their autonomy. We're going to show compassion and understanding for the other person, and we are going to evoke their wisdom rather than beating them over the head with our ideas. And paradoxically, we get a lot further, a lot faster when we come at communication with the attitude of PACE. By the way, any questions? If you have questions, feel free to unmute yourself, and I'm happy to take a question here and there, or if you'd like to save those for toward the end, we can do it that way as well. Any questions?
Think, for the sake of the flow, Dave, we'll just encourage people to use the chat, and then we'll make sure to get to them in the Q&A period for the sake of your flow and focus.
That sounds good. Let's do it that way. So there's a series of stages that you've probably noticed people go through as they move from being fully resistant to an approach to fully involved and ready to make plans to move forward. And with motivational interviewing, we recognize these steps as, in the first stage, we have to engage people and establish a partnership with them. We have to then establish a focus where we clarify the agenda and how their agenda and ours can mesh. Then we want to evoke reasons for change, but we're paradoxically going to begin with their reasons for moving in the desired direction rather than ours. Blaise Pascal, famous scientist, once said that people are persuaded much better by their own reasons than by those that come from the mind of another. Motivational interviewing takes advantage of this principle by eliciting the reasons for change that the other party has. We'll show you how to do that. And finally, we want, obviously, to get to a plan where we are planning to collaborate. And in this case, of course, that's all about getting the Energy Innovation Carbon Dividend Act passed. This is one of the skill sets we'll focus on in detail tonight, ORS. This is the fundamental communication backbone of motivational interviewing. We use open-ended questions, affirmations, reflective listening, and summaries to move the discussion forward and keep it on track in a productive direction. And we'll be demonstrating this in detail here shortly. So let's go back, and we're going to cover these two components, PACE and ORS, in some depth. Let's take a look at this partnership that we've been talking about. What we're trying to do here is establish a collaborative relationship. The last thing we want to do is establish an adversarial relationship. Once the other party sees us as an adversary, they are inclined to stiffen their defenses and bristle at what we are bringing to the table. We want to see them as partners instead of others. So in motivational interviewing, we don't see them as our opponents. We don't see them as the problem. We see them as our collaborators, and with this, we greatly reduce defensiveness. We're also see them as that our goal is to work together as a team after we find common goals, and we're quite creative in how we get to those common goals. Acceptance means that we recognize the absolute worth of the other person. This is unconditional caring. Now, most of us have a hard time with this. We're going to give you some examples of how to do this. If you have a member of Congress who is dead set against anything you have to say, it's very easy to see that person as an adversary. And as soon as you've got that attitude, it tends to leak. And what we mean by attitude leaking is the other party can smell your attitude. It shows. They detect it. And so this isn't about faking something. It's about finding genuine reasons to appreciate the other party, even though at first blush they are strikingly opposed to things that you hold dear. And we'll give you some ways to do that. We want to show accurate empathy, which means we really want to show that we understand both what they're stating and what they're implying. I'll give you examples of that in a role play here shortly. We'll respect their autonomy. We don't go in and say, you have to vote for this. You must do that. That's a great way to breed resistance. We have to recognize from the outset they are free to do as they see fit. And finally, we want to affirm their strengths instead of criticizing them. CCL is very good at this. As most of you who have done lobbying know, we tend to start with an appreciation when we go into a congressional or other office. This is absolutely consistent with the MI approach. It'll be very familiar to you. Compassion means that we're showing an active understanding of their thoughts, feelings, values, circumstances. You can only do this if you do your homework. By doing your homework, I mean you have to study the other party and really get acquainted with where they stand. And there are many sources through which you can do this. You can go to their website. You can take a look at the notes that your former CCL members have taken in their lobby sessions with this individual. There are numerous sources of data that you can draw upon to really get a good understanding of where your partner, the other person, stands with regard to these issues so that you're well-informed and can reflect that in the course of the conversation. This is one of the most paradoxical parts of MI is evocation, the E in PACE. For many of us, we've been led to adopt a model that when we persuade others, we have correct ideas in our head. Our objective is to open their mind and pour our correct ideas into their head, and now everything's good. We have successfully transferred correct information and all is well. That approach works nicely on paper, but rarely very well in practice. What we find works much better in with motivational interviewing is that we are going to draw their ideas and their solutions out. Now, this is scary because it feels much more, we feel more in control if we're running the show and saying, here's what has to happen. But if you can relinquish a bit of that control and set the stage properly, you can elicit the other person's ideas for change, and it's much more likely to get movement in the desired direction than if we're pushing our agenda. So this is much more akin to Aikido or certain martial arts in which you go with the other person's energy rather than trying to resist it. And of course, one of the reasons that they like this approach is because we help them see how going the direction we want to go will serve their values. And that's a very helpful thing. That's evocation. Well, how do you practice PACE? Many of you grew up with I'm guessing most of you on this call, like myself, are old enough to remember the Hokey Pokey. This was a silly little song that we sang as kids. And most of you remember that when you do the Hokey Pokey, you put your whole self in, you put your whole self out, and then you turn yourself about. That's what this is about. We use this as kind of a joking way to point out that sometimes we have to turn our attitude completely about if we've got a negative attitude before we go in to interact with another party. So let me give you an example of how I do this. I have been a part of our local delegation. I'm here in northern Utah right now, Logan, and our local congressperson, his office is about 25 miles away. it's been easy as we drive that 25 miles for my fellow CCLers to talk about all the ways in which that member of Congress is not performing the way they would like that member of Congress to perform. Unfortunately, this puts us in a cranky mood and not the kind of mood or attitude that we want to interact effectively with our member of Congress. So let's take a look at some things that work much better. In fact, we found to be more effective, and this is now how we practice when we're getting ready to go see our member of Congress now. What I'd like you to do, I'm going to show you how to practice this kind of emotional turnaround. What I'd like each of you to do is think of someone you'd like to influence. So this could be your member of Congress. It could be somebody in your CCL chapter that you need to collaborate with and you need to get some compliance or some unity with. What I'd like you to do is write down a negative attitude that you hold about this person. So for example, for my member of Congress, it might be easy for me to have an attitude that they just don't get it. They don't see the importance of getting carbon out of the atmosphere. And how stupid is that? I mean, the evidence is so abundantly clear. Let's suppose that's my attitude. So let me invite you to just take a pencil and jot down in one sentence or maybe two, your attitude. Pick an attitude that is negative about the person you would like to collaborate with. Once you've got that written down, let me invite you to write a more compassionate view. So let's suppose I'm doing this with my member of Congress and I've got the negative view I just mentioned. Now I want to challenge myself to identify good things about this member of Congress. I'll give you some actual ones about my member of Congress. I know that he's a former eighth grade geography teacher. Well, he knows what it's like to be a teacher, and my family is full of teachers. My wife is a teacher, most of my siblings are teachers, my parent was a teacher, and so are my grandparents. So I have something in common with this person. He knows what it's like to be in the trenches and try to persuade other people. By the way, if you can persuade eighth graders to do anything, you are achieving miracles. So I begin to identify commonalities, connections, ways that I can empathize with this other party, similarities and good things about them. He's been an educator. He has the best interest of kids and students at heart. Then I want to see good intentions. Now, with regard to his attitude about our bill, although he hasn't expressed support for it yet, I understand, I've met with him enough times to know that he does have good intentions. I have heard him talk about interacting with former President Obama when he was here in Utah in a very positive way about carbon sequestration, something that is obviously of interest in our cause. And finally, we want to see the reasonability of their perspective. Now, this isn't from our perspective. We want to step into their mind and see how their view makes sense given their assumptions and their world. Because it's so easy to denigrate the other person's viewpoint. We want to actually see why their view makes sense from their perspective. So take just another minute or two and see what you can come up with. This little challenge to you. This is an exercise in empathy, compassion, and understanding, which if you're not in the habit of practicing it, it's going to be a little tricky. But take another minute, and then I'm going to invite, hopefully, some of you who will be willing to share with us what's the negative attitude that you hold about this party. You don't have to name names. As you know, we prefer not to identify specific individuals unless necessary, and it usually isn't necessary. What's important here is what's your negative attitude and how can you use these three questions to help yourself reverse that attitude a bit? In fact, let's go ahead. Has anybody got some points they'd like to share with us, things they've come up with to help adjust an attitude?
This is Markley.
Markley.
Should I just go?
Just jump right in. Let's begin, Markley, maybe with telling us what's the negative attitude that you'd like to modify a bit?
So So I am a physician and I quit my job to work on climate change. And I'm trying to get other physicians passionate about this. And I specifically work with people with disabilities. So I'm trying to get doctors that care for people with disabilities to start caring about climate change. And basically, I've been doing lots of rounds, and the reality is these physicians don't see climate change as something they should care about. That's basically what I've gotten out of this. And that obviously annoys me, and I'm a little upset about it. And so my positive, more compassionate view is that physician X, because it's more than one person, worked hard to get in a situation where they can care for their patients, and they think that they're the best at this, and this is their only job, and obviously they've got a financial reason that they do this. And they think that climate change is, because of this, an issue that other people should take care of. And so I need to kind of obviously constantly think about that to change my attitude, because it's hard.
Yes. So you're starting to see it from their perspective. They're busy physicians. They have heavy caseloads. This is a hard issue for them to see the importance of. Their training is to help individuals with disabilities. Why should they expand their focus to something that is so global, so macro level, when they spend most of their days focused on the micro level of one person's problems at a time?
Yes.
Great. So there, what I see you doing is you're seeing the reasonability of their perspective. And that is, the things you've mentioned are really nice ones, I'm going to suggest, to share once you interact with them, to let them know that you really understand their position. And as we get into reflective listening, I think you're going to see that, boy, the material you just came up with makes for great reflections, because I'll bet you're going to hear that kind of thing from them, and you'll have an occasion to reflect that back to show that you really understand that viewpoint. One of the reasons that people are scared to show this kind of empathy for the other person's viewpoint is the fear that you are going to support their intransigence or their firmness in their existing opinion. But this is one of the many paradoxical findings in motivational interviewing, that if we show empathy for a viewpoint very different from ours, it actually softens the other person up to listen to our viewpoint. It's as though like begets like. If you show compassion and understanding, you're much more likely to receive it from the other party. So that's a lovely example. Thank you. Now let's move to the second skill set. We're going to put a little more attention on this one because it's a very active part of MI. This is OARS, which is our acronym for open-ended questions, affirmations, reflective listening, and summaries. So let's go through each of those points, OARS, in some detail now. How do we open dialogue with open questions? Well, first of all, let's get clear on the difference between an open question and a closed question. A closed question is one that calls for a yes or no answer. It does not open dialogue. It tends to shut dialogue down. But it's very easy to ask open-ended or closed-ended questions. So, for example, it's not a good idea to go in and start off your interaction saying, Senator Jones, are you willing to vote for H.R. 763? If they're not ready, you just got a no, and you've also kind of closed off the discussion at that point. So we want to open the dialogue and get the process of back and forth going. Open questions almost always contain one of the six W's, which is who, what, when, where, why, and how. Well, I know how has a W, it's at the back end, so we allow it into the W club. Those are your little workhorses, the six W's. Anytime you've got one of those six W terms in a sentence, a question, you've got an open-ended question, and it's likely to get the other person expanding on whatever topic you've asked about. So, closed-ended question, would you support our proposal? Yes or no? Not a good question. Open question. How much do you know about our proposal? Much better question. Gets them talking. So those are open-ended questions, and I'll be demonstrating some of those here in a minute. Brett has agreed to play a senator, and here, after we've covered the Orr's principles, he's agreed to play a senator, and I'm going to, I don't know what he's going to say or what his opinions are yet, but I aim to find out a bit and practice Orr's, and you'll see me use some open questions. By the way, our model here is that you're going to watch me do this, and then after you watch me do this, we're going to break you into breakout sessions with a partner, one partner, and let you practice Orr's as well. So pay careful attention. You'll be doing this in a matter of a few minutes. Affirmations. This is something CCL, of course, is very good at already. We always like to go in with an appreciation, and that's the same as an affirmation. We want to simply put a spotlight on anything positive with regard to their actions, their abilities, their strengths, their efforts, their values. And by the way, if they've done nothing to move in the direction we'd like them to, we want to at least affirm their intentions, where we see good intentions. So there's almost always something that we can affirm if we look for it. And again, one of the best places to get those affirmations is from being acquainted with them and knowing their history, their voting record, their website, and any pot notes that you have access to of your CCL's former interactions with that individual. This is probably the single most important skill. If you took nothing else away tonight, I hope you get a little bit excited about good reflective listening. It's a real strong tool for turning attitudes around, building connection and collaboration. What is it? It means that we paraphrase back to them our best understanding of their thoughts, their feelings, both the pros and cons as they see it for what we're talking about, both on a stated level, and that's the surface level, and also on an implied or a deep level. So that's a lot. I don't expect you to absorb all that at first blush, but I will give you some examples and illustrations, especially as we get into the role play. So reflective listening is an art. It takes time to get good at it, like anything else. You'll see people who do it very poorly, where they simply parrot back word for word what the other person said. That sounds very canned. It's usually not very helpful. Instead, what you're doing is reflecting the gist, the essence of what the other person's saying. And you're doing it in a way as a kind of a question to make sure that you do understand what they're saying. And it helps the other person feel really heard when you do this. You'll hopefully see the difference this makes in our role play. Here's some guidelines for reflective listening. We used the metaphor of an iceberg. So most of you know that an iceberg, if you've studied icebergs much, you know that about 1/7 of the iceberg's mass is visible above the water, and that puts the other 6/7 below the surface. And this is a good metaphor for how communication with others works. You hear what they're saying, but there's a lot of ideas, thoughts, and feelings that undergird what's being said that are below the surface. So a deep reflection is one where we add some meaning or feeling to what the person has said to see if we understand the assumptions on which that statement is based. It's okay to make a guess about what the other person means. So in your reflection, you can state your best understanding or guess, speculation about what they're trying to convey, and then you let them either confirm or disconfirm that you've got it right. One way of thinking of this is it's like continuing the paragraph. If the person starts off with two or three sentences, you look at where those sentences are pointing, continue that paragraph a bit to see if you understand, and they'll let you know if you do or not. Finally, summaries. And summaries can be offered at several points during an interaction with another party, but the place you definitely want to make a good summary is toward the end of your interaction, because a summary is strategic. We're not just interacting with people for the sake of a nice chat. We have intentions, we have purposes. We want HR 763 to pass. We have a clear goal here. So what we do with a summary is we summarize the points that have been discussed, A, B, and C, and then we make a link as to how that points towards D, which is the next step. Now, that may not be the final step, which is to vote for HR 763, but some intermediate ask. And so in CCL language, this is where we are making our ask. And it could be a big ask, a little ask, a short term, or any kind of ask that keeps the person moving in the desired direction. With this kind of summary, you don't want to make it so big that it's easy for them to say no. You want to increase the probabilities that they're going to say yes. And there's a reason for this. The psychological research shows that if you can get a person to say yes to a small ask, this is called the foot in the door technique, by the way, they are much more likely to say yes to a bigger ask down the road. We won't go into the reasons for this. It's actually something we cover in our other webinar on effective communications. But suffice it to say, good summaries get people moving in the right direction. So this is where we use them to make an ask. Same for demonstration. So here's what we're going to do. Again, Brett has agreed to play a senator, and the setting is this. I am a member of a CCL team. We are coming to visit Senator Cease in his Washington, D.C. office. We have met with Senator Cease before. He is tepid. He is ambivalent about his support for HR 763. It's not that he's totally against it, but he certainly is yet to sign on to it. And so in this case, we are going to try to nudge him in the direction of greater support. And that's kind of what our mission is for this next visit we're having with him. Anything else you'd like to add to that, Senator Cease, before we start?
Yeah, sure. Just as a little context, I come from an agricultural state. You know, I've continued to signal interest in talking about practical bipartisan solutions to managing emissions. But I really haven't indicated any outright support for ambitious policies like the Energy Innovation Act in the past.
Sounds good. Well, let's go ahead and launch into this. And again, what I'm going to have you as our audience members do, as you eavesdrop on this conversation between myself and Senator Cease, I'd like you to write on a paper in front of you the letters O-A-R-S, ORS. Every time you hear me ask an open-ended question, put a check next to the O. When you hear me make an affirmation of some sort, put a check by the A. When I ask or I offer a reflection, put a check by the R. And if you hear what sounds like a summary of some sort, put a check by the S. When we're done, I'll ask you as the audience how many O's, A's, R's, and S's you detected in the course of this conversation. Again, you're just focusing on what I'm doing as the advocate, so you only have one person to track. And the reason I want you to track this is so you're developing an ear and an eye for what O's looks like. Watch for it so that you can see what it looks like in real action. All right. Well, with that, it's a pleasure to be here in your office again, Senator Cease. It's been about 6 months, I think, since we were here last. How are you doing today?
Yeah, we're doing great. Obviously, just an ongoing pleasure of ours here too, Dr. Christian. We definitely appreciate having a chance to hear from the folks back in district about what you guys are up to, and have always really appreciated learning a little bit more each time about what you guys are focusing on. So thank you.
Well, and we want to express some specific appreciation. I watched with considerable interest that rather outspoken floor speech that you made, and we really appreciate the positive things that you said thus far. We just wanted to acknowledge that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think, again, I know you guys are focused on climate change advocacy, and in my opinion, one of the big focuses that has not received as much attention as it should is just carbon sequestration. How can we make sure any emissions, CO2 emissions wise that we're producing can be captured and permanently stored rather than emitted? So,
Boy, and as you probably know, that's completely consistent with our goals and objectives at CCL. Of course, our HR 763 is intended to do the same thing, to get carbon out of the atmosphere. The Use It Act, of course, is a great way to do that via sequestration. And our program, of course, has other mechanisms, bipartisan ones, to achieve that same end. Last time we were here in your office, we left some information. I believe we left a copy of the REMI report and some other things in response to questions you had about HR 763. And we're just wondering what questions might still remain in your mind about how it works and things that you would need to feel comfortable supporting it.
Yeah, well, I think at this point we're continuing a dialogue here. I definitely am not in a position to be interested in supporting it at this point, but one of the biggest things that I think my staff drew up was, as you know, I'm coming from a state that, you know, clearly has a lot of rural residents, and I think we're quite concerned about the impact of any escalating price on especially our families that can least afford any cost of energy transition. With, you know, a budget that's already fairly fixed from commuting to home fuels, you know, we don't want to have anything that has a detrimental impact to their own livelihoods.
Boy, I think I hear what you're saying there. With an agrarian economy like we have in our state, this is a very sensitive issue. I hear you saying that a lot of our folks in our state are on those fixed incomes, and anything that poses a bigger financial burden to them would be a real concern. How much do you know about the dividend part of our program that aims to address that? Is that something that, how much do you know about the dividend side, which is the part that that tries to address that piece?
Yeah, I mean, we're familiar with the dividend. I think the big question that I have is, you know, from looking at it, we weren't quite sure if, you know, giving it back equally to all households would still look out for more rural households.
That's a good point. Yeah, let me share a little information and see what you think about this. The dividend does come back equally, and yet the cost is not achieved equally. So for those who are very high consumers and users of carbon, and those who are putting a lot of carbon in the atmosphere, they of course are going to pay a higher or a disproportionately higher amount for that. So the little guy who just gasses up his car once in a while will pay a bit more at the pump for gas over time. However, the people who are using the most carbon, the big consumers, are going to pay a disproportionately greater amount of that. So actually the people, the little guys, actually stand to come out much better with carbon fee and dividend than those who are at the higher end. So those that have the greater capacity to pay, that's already automatically built in and built into the program. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that mechanism for addressing that concern. How does that sound to you?
I think it makes sense on the broadest level. I guess the biggest thing that would be helpful for us is to really understand the nuts and the bolts of it as it affects our own state residents. So if you could provide additional information that we can look at that really helps us assess whether that is the case or not, I think would be a key next step.
So if I'm hearing you right, it sounds like a real concern is that you would need hard facts, some data, good numbers that illustrate how that is going to work for the people in your constituents, especially the little guys who obviously are in the more precarious position. You need some hard numbers about how that's going to work for them. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's who put me in office here. That's who I'm representing, and that's who I'm most concerned about. Yep.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, we will. It sounds like the next thing that we need to do is when we come back to your office. In fact, I think we could get those numbers earlier. Would the best way to give those to you would be that I know we've sent you things by email. If we could get those numbers to you through email, how would that work for you?
That's great. Yeah, you've been in touch with Tammy and have always been prompt with any follow-up. So just route them to her and, you know, the office will look at them as we have time.
Well, I appreciate your openness to this. It's a real refreshing to us going from one office to another to have folks that are open to data, database solutions, and we certainly appreciate your openness to this, and we'll be happy to get that information. And it sounds like you're also willing to vote for the Use It Act when it makes its way to the Senate floor, if I'm understanding. Is that the direction you're leaning at this point?
We're interested in it. We definitely are happy to see the bipartisan support it gained in the House, and I've certainly been having a lot of conversations with other senators and the developers of the policy to figure out its impact here, too.
Wow. We sure appreciate your consideration of it, and certainly the good things you've been doing thus far with regard to carbon sequestration, and we'll look forward to getting that information to you probably within the next week. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, it's an honor, and obviously keep up the great work. We really appreciate working with groups like you that are obviously well-informed and invested in this democratic process. So thank you, Dr. Christian.
It's been a pleasure. Take care until next time. So as we step back, let me first of all check with, our habit in these role plays to check with the person who's on the receiving end of MI, which is Brett in this case. What was that like? What parts of that worked for you? What parts felt like I was maybe pushing too hard? Overall your sense of what it was like to be in the senator's seat.
What the two things that stood out most for me, and I'd love to hear what other thoughts are on this too, was just the reflective listening clearly did seem to advance the dialogue and indicated that you were not only listening, but really trying to find a workable solution that was of interest for both parties. And I think the part that was also most effective was just really trying to figure out the best way for me as somebody that was clearly concerned about certain impacts from a policy perspective to really kind of get the information or the additional concerns that I had addressed.
Sounds good. Let's open it up to the rest of our viewers tonight. What did you get for O's, A's, R's, and S's? Anybody want to share their tally of those, just in terms of the sheer mechanics? What did you get?
This is Shaul from Southern California. So I got a bunch of open-ended. I got 7 open-ended questions. I have 5 affirmations, 2 reflections, and 1 summary. Summarizing.
All right. Oh, thank you for that. Sounds like you were really paying attention. Let's check and see what others got. By the way, there's some people are a little more stringent in what they count as a reflection. So if you got fewer than that, it doesn't mean you're wrong. It just means maybe you have a little tighter criteria for what counts.
I only got 3 open, open-ended questions. Maybe you count, it seemed to me you asked a couple of questions in a row. So I just counted them as 1. And I got 5 affirmations, the same as the previous person. I got 2 reflections, and I got 2 summaries.
Very nice. So what you've illustrated here is what we always see. Different people define O's, A's, and R's, and S's a little differently, and that's perfectly fine. The takeaway from this is when you practice O's, and I strongly recommend that you do, in little role plays you can do, all you got to do is grab one other person, and you can do a role play like we're about to do. It actually works nicely in role plays to have 3 people, 2 that play the roles that Brett and I played, and a 3rd person who keeps the O's count. That way it frees up somebody to pay a little attention as the observer. So with that, our encouragement is to keep on practicing. We have next steps here. Practice pace and O's with your friends and family. And any thoughts, Brett, that you'd like to share about what's coming up next and where we go from here?
Yeah, let me just put a link. As you can see here, I'm just going to show you where to go to get to the Effective Communications Action Team, because that's going to be your ongoing main point of contact with ongoing reflections on putting this into practice. There is an October webinar scheduled, so you can find out more information there. And beyond Dave's recommendation to really put this into practice in other settings outside of even just congressional role-playing, we also do recommend if you have any thoughts, reflections, or ways that you have continued to find benefit from being able to implement this in your own life, feel free to share in the forums. And you can also email me with any further clarifications. I can send Dave anything that we didn't get to tonight if we did move too quickly. and get more information for you. So there's my email listed at brett@citizensclimate.org. And with that, we thank you, Dave, for a wonderful webinar tonight. So thank you all for being on the line, and we hope that you found tonight's presentation useful. And we look forward to putting this in practice throughout all of our outreach and ahead.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Brett.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.